Hey, Matt.
Yo.
What are you doing Monday, April 29th?
I'm not really planning on doing anything, but what are you alluding to?
I might be trying to invite you to go to Hey Neighbor, which is a dinner happening in downtown Cary, Monday, April 29th.
Oh, wait a second. I did hear about it because it's with our good friends, mm-hmm. Matthew Bettinger of Sidebar. It has Bond Brothers Beer Company. Yep. Locals Oyster Bar is also coming out for it. Mm-hmm. And upcoming guest on the podcast, Pizzeria Felizzi is going to be there along with their neighbor, Pro's Epicurean Market and Cafe. They're all collaborating for that dinner.
That's right. If you've ever been to that area, you'll know that they have this big oak tree. It's going to happen all outside under the oak. It will feature a raw bar. There will be Bond Brothers beer, of course. There's wine. There are cocktails by Sidebar. There's live music, antipasti. There's a family style dinner.
Yeah. And I think it's all, actually, I know it's all for $100. And a portion of those proceeds will go towards UNC Children's Hospital.
Right. So to get tickets, you go to heyneighbor.eventbrite.com or click the link in our show notes.
And now the show.
You're listening to the North Carolina Food and Beverage Podcast, coming to you from the kitchen studios located high atop the historic Raleigh Building, located in the heart of downtown Raleigh. The NCF&B Podcast takes you behind the scenes of North Carolina's food and beverage industry. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at NCFBPod. And now, the sommeliers to the stars, the barbacks in your backyard, it is Max and Matt.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Food and Beverage Podcast. I am your co-host, Max Trujillo.
And I am your co-host, Matthew Weiss, and we are stepping actually out of North Carolina today and into the kitchen of one up-and-coming bright young author, Ms. Anna Frances Goss, who is the author of the upcoming book, Heirloom Kitchen, which is heritage recipes and family stories from the tables of immigrant women. Welcome, Anna.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And we are using technology today, but yeah. I think it's going to be crystal clear. You're hearing us well, Anna?
I am.
Yeah. She's coming to us from the comfy digs of Connecticut over there, where she lives with her three kids and her husband, Phil, my old college roommate. So we're buddies. And this is going to lead me into something. I have a bone to pick with you.
Already?
I'm not yet.
Wow. We just started.
I'm not going to bring up the wedding invitation again. Okay. So I'm not going to do that. God. But it's another one. So, Anna, we were like essentially roommates for almost a year in college at NYU. Mm-hmm.
Like pretty much. We were neighbors.
Yeah, we were neighbors. Yeah. Our good friend Eric Choi was eating like ramen almost every single day. I was eating like tuna fish out of a can and getting turkey sandwiches from Deleon. Mm-hmm. What the heck? Like, you never cooked for us or showed this culinary expertise at all. What's going on?
Did you ever go in that fraternity kitchen?
Yes. It was pretty nasty, but I mean, yeah. You got to.
Somebody was living in there, sleeping under the bar.
That's true. Yes, big dog.
So, you know, it wasn't really up to code, I would say.
Right.
Like you were separate with the tuna sandwiches.
Okay.
All
gotcha.
Right. Well, let's get a little point of reference over here. So we did break the rules. We're a North Carolina food and beverage podcast. And even Matt was saying before the show started, he's like, how are we going to relate this back to North Carolina? And I just looked at him and said, we're not. We're just going to say, screw it. We're breaking the rules. Because if you listen to this show at this point, you know that we know that you have an interest in food or beverage or both. And you possibly live in North Carolina or don't. But it's irrelevant to great content and something that's focused on what we do, and that's food and beverage. And Anna, being that she is an old buddy of Matt's, but also more importantly, about to release a fantastic cookbook with a great insight and a specific edge of which we will get to in a moment. We just said, no, we got to get her on the show because this is super cool. If the only tie that I can think of is the tie that we talk to chefs all the time about how they were inspired by their grandma, how they're inspired by growing up and how they became a better chef because of the environment of which they grew up. And so that leads me to at least kind of define this grandmas.
Yeah. Right?
Grandmas. That's the key word of the day. If this was Pee-wee's Playhouse, everyone would scream every time we'd say grandmas. And I say
except
that
we would say Nona in this case.
Nona. So you write a cookbook. This cookbook that's coming out essentially is a cookbook telling the technique and recipes of grandmothers from all over the world who immigrated to New York, or at least the neighboring areas. Is that a good evaluation of what's going on?
Well, yeah, but it's not just the tri-state area, New York, Connecticut, New Jersey. I also have some grandmothers from other parts of the country. But it was more about finding women that came here for, you know, we say a better life or the American dream, and raised kids and created an environment for their children to grow up as Americans, but continue to cook their food. So I absolutely think it relates very much to most chefs, because most chefs will tell you that they did start cooking at a young age or relatively at a young age. And most of them, their first inspiration was their mother or their grandmother. And we all know a lot of people in this country are either first or second generation. So the food that was in their home was the food of, you know, the old country, yeah, you know, for lack of a better term. So, you know, that was my experience growing up, and the experience of all of the first gen kids I interviewed for this and that lent me their mothers. So that's kind of how we got there.
That leads me to your grandma.
My grandma has passed on and she never immigrated. So my mother is in the book because my mother is a grandmother.
All right.
So the first grandmother in this book is actually my mom. And she immigrated with me. I was 1 year old, and she continued to cook the food of my grandmother back in Italy. So that's kind of where I got that inspiration. Yeah. And she cooks that food now for my children.
Yeah, she's known. Well, what I love about this is, and first of all, I don't think we've given you your due praise, because Anna isn't just somebody who cooks at home. You've worked for Martha Stewart and been a major recipe tester for her, and also worked for Whole Foods, and I think still currently are testing recipes for Food 52. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I went to culinary school in New York City, French Culinary Institute. And then, you know, at the time I already had two kids. So working the line in a restaurant late nights wasn't the career trajectory of my choice. So I went to school with the intention of food media, and what that meant, I didn't know, but I decided, all right, I need to be somewhere in that realm. I was like a Food Network addict at the time, and also print. So I got there. I, you know, went through the program. They were quite helpful in getting me really great internships. So I went to Martha and then Food 52, who I do still work for today. But the main thing that I fell in love with working in the test kitchens was not only the writing, but the recipe testing. And that's just basically going through a recipe and making sure it works. The one thing I did learn, well, not the one thing, but the most important thing I learned at Martha, and this comes straight from Martha, is
tax evasion. Tax evasion?
Well, she didn't teach me that.
Okay. I was just wondering. I didn't know.
In case there's any IRS auditors on the line. But she did teach me precision in recipe testing. Mm-hmm. That if it's going to go up on the website, if it's going to be in the magazine, it has to be perfect. It has to work.
Yeah.
So I really loved the science of that. And it's kind of funny how that led me to this, because when you get into a kitchen with a grandmother, it's the exact opposite of that. It's, you know, a dash of this and, you know, a sprinkle of that. And it's mayhem, you know, because I'm trying to get them to stop and, you know, just take their time. But the thing that I did find out was that even though it seems like it's very haphazard, there is an absolute precision to that chaos. So even though it might seem like, oh, they're just throwing everything in, and they are, they're throwing the exact same things in at the exact same time every time.
And you just have to record those measurements so that they're accurate for others can do it exactly the same.
Exactly. So every person in the book, I actually went to their home and physically cooked with them. It was really the only way I could do it.
Yeah. But what I love about it, even before we get into your process about writing the recipes, is, and most people, I feel like, don't have a very specific one, but you actually had an aha moment. So take us back to the aha moment for this book.
Right. So back in 2015, I'm recipe testing for work. I'm doing all these different things. And I just kind of realized that I have all these recipes that I've worked on, yet I don't know how to make anything my mom cooks. And that's because my mom always cooks it. You know, we'll all pile in her house on Sunday and she makes her, you know, rotation of things that we love. So I never had to do it. But I got to this point where I was like, I need to know how to do it. And I know my mom's just doing it out of her head. I want this stuff written down. These are family heirlooms, you know, just like you pass on, you know, a painting or a ring or whatever. These are recipes that are really important. And they, I believe they tell my family story. So I got my mom in the kitchen and we created this little project. And we called it the Meatball Project because we started with her meatballs. And we went from there. And then I think my even bigger aha moment was I went to NYU and like my friends could represent the United Nations. I really need to see who out of my friends would love me to do this for them because this is like a service I can provide that's mutually beneficial because I get to learn how to make all these great authentic recipes and they're going to get something written down and recorded forever. Sent out an email. It was like wildfire. Everybody wrote back. Let's do this. I want you to, you know, my mom first, she's on Long Island, you know, my mom second, she's in San Francisco. So I just started traveling around and I was so excited by the fact that one, people saw value to this, like I did, and that everyone had like exactly what I needed to make. Like Matt and I have a friend named Eric Choi and he's Chinese.
I know Eric.
Yeah.
You know Eric.
I know Eric because at Matt's wedding, which we alluded to in a recent episode of this podcast, Matt asked Eric and myself to play guitar at his wedding because Eric's a great guitarist and I am a mediocre guitarist. But we played together during the processional. Is that where,
yes,
like, where Sarah is walking down the aisle? And we played some traditional Jewish hymns, but then we also played a U2 track. And it was really fun. I got to meet that guy, and he's a really cool dude. And
yes,
pretty good musician.
Yeah, very good musician. But yeah, and so Eric Choi has now been mentioned twice on the show. He gets his just due. So he's out in San Francisco, and his mom lives there now, and that's who you went to cook with.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And Eric had a list of things that he really wanted me to make with her. The other thing that happened with the very first woman that I cooked with was, you know, we're sitting there, we're cooking, we're talking, and just kind of organically, I said to her, why'd you come to this country? You know, what's your immigration story? What made you leave Greece? And she just kind of, you know, was telling me the story about why she decided to leave her family and come here. And it was very similar to my mom. You know, we've heard the story many times. But when you're kind of standing in someone's kitchen and they're explaining it to you and you're thinking, my God, this is exactly why my mom came here, you know, with different ideas and you know, experiences throughout, but the main theme was the same. I was like, this is so exciting too. And this is something that should be recorded. So when I started my blog to share these recipes, I also started sharing the women's stories. And I think that's what the book really presents in a different way. That you're not just getting a cookbook of 100 recipes, you're getting 40 really beautiful stories. And I promise you, if you are Greek, you will absolutely relate to her story, Italian, you know, Armenian, whatever you are. there's this common thread and it's really nice. It's really nice to kind of share that and to celebrate that.
Well, I mean, that's endearing in itself. And, I wonder, so just for our audience, what are some of the various countries and cultures that you've already explained a few of them right now, but could you go through a wider net to let us know who you covered?
Yeah, so once I got a book deal, I was like, okay, where are the holes to fill in? But what I realized was just kind of, I think like, I don't know, the universe helping me as I was getting referred from kitchen to kitchen, I really was hitting every continent. So it was really nice when I kind of looked at everybody that I had, how I had a really nice representation. So, I mean, all the continents are there. There's Europe. So in Europe, I have Italy, Russia, the Ukraine, Scotland, Germany. I did Berlin and Hamburg because, first of all, I got referred to two women that were both from Germany. But the second thing that was so great is Germany has very different cuisines in Hamburg and in Berlin. So that was nice to kind of touch on. And Scotland, Serbia, and then, you know, Asia, I did Korea.
Did you make some haggis in Scotland?
It's so funny. She didn't want to.
Why?
She didn't want to because she said, you know, I don't think people will eat it. I won't eat it. And so with Scotland, I did Cullen skink, which is a fish chowder.
Oh.
And then this dessert called tablet, which is a sickeningly sweet fudge.
Okay.
But it's eaten all over the UK. And the funny thing is, like, if you mention it to people from England, they go crazy.
Mm.
But, like, your teeth, like, shake when you eat it. It's so sugary. But they love it.
What about South America? Do you do any fun stuff from South America?
Yeah, I mean, what I did was, I don't know why, like, I'm blanking now on my table of contents, but I did kind of go all over the place. But I have a whole bunch of women, like, I did Cuba, I did the Dominican, because my sister-in-law married a Dominican guy, so I got his wife, his mom, and then what else do we have here?
Did you go to Africa?
I did. Africa, I have Ghana. Egypt, which is kind of border.
Sure.
And then where's my third lovely African woman from? Morocco.
Oh,
so
oh, wow.
We did a tagine and we did almond cookies that they eat with their tea. And it's just really nice. And one thing that I did kind of like on a strategic level was when I went into the kitchens, it was like, all right, the first thing was it has to be something that your kids absolutely love. Like when your kids came home from college, what did you have to have on the table? Or what do you make on Sundays?
Yeah.
And then the second thing was it's got to be something other Dominicans eat. You know, like I can't be just something that you created in your kitchen.
Yeah.
And what was funny was everybody wanted to cook their national dish for me. It's like, it has not to be the national dish. Yeah. But they're like, oh, well, this is what everybody eats. And then I Google it and it was always the national dish. So that's one thing that I think is great. If, you know, you're Dominican, you definitely eat sancocho and it's in my book. So
everyone can go make it.
Yes. And it's just what it is. It's just something that people will relate to and say, okay. Or if, you know, your grandmother has passed and you don't have her recipe, well, use my recipe as a starting point, you know, get back in the kitchen, figure it out.
So Anna, I want to talk about something real quick. We're going to take a quick break and get back. And I want to hear a little bit if there's any beverage component and a couple more special dishes. And also we're going to plug your book. But talk about things that people can relate to is having fears about business. And so Forest Firm helps lots of people starting out their business.
That's right.
We're going to take a little break from the show for a new segment with the Forest Firm. The Forest Firm are business attorneys across North Carolina, and Jen Hoverstadt is an attorney within their system. Jen is a good friend of ours. Jen, are you there on the phone?
I am. I'm here. I love talking to you guys.
Everybody has legal questions, especially in the food and beverage industry. So that's why we've provided Jen and the Forest Firm to help us out. And if you follow us on Instagram at NCFBpod, we'll put out a post weekly from Forest Firm and ask a question. It might be the question that we ask Jen on the show.
All right. So Max and I were talking about in the life of the restaurant and food and beverage, there's a lot of issues with who's sharing what on social media and who owns the origination of the ideas. Are you seeing, legally speaking, in the F&B world regarding these types of issues?
We see intellectual property issues in the food and beverage industry, I would say almost on a weekly basis. And here is the best tip for people listening who own a business. Go ahead and right now today, set up a Google alert for your business name or perhaps your product names, because you're going to be able to see if someone is also using the same name either for their business or for their product. Because as soon as you become aware of it, you're going to want to put the infringing group on notice that, hey, I've had this, I have my trademark filed, or I've been using this for a while, and you know, I see you guys are just starting to use this. We got to talk about this now, because a lot of IP issues might be able to be resolved at the beginning before a business really gets up and running, because chances are it was just a harmless mistake, but you want to make sure you catch it right away to give both businesses the opportunity to come to a conclusion and kind of a mutual agreement on how this is going to operate. Now, of course, if that doesn't work out, our IP team at Forest Firm is happy to step in and be a bit more formal and send someone a cease and desist on using what's your property. But we got to make sure it's filed, and then we got to make sure that you're using it on a regular basis. And our IP attorneys can take care of all of that for you.
If you're a chef, you created recipes for a restaurant. Mm-hmm. Who owns those recipes, and what happens when that said chef leaves the restaurant?
That is a good question. And this is something that both the chef and the business owner need to talk about at the beginning. And this could even apply to groups like marketing agencies where someone is bringing in a talent that they already have. But for our chefs, what you want to do is outline it in your employment agreement to say who owns the recipes. Mm. Typically, the restaurant is going to own anything that is created while the chef was at the restaurant. That's going to be pretty standard language, but you always want to know what that is. And if for some reason you decide to create something that is outside of the restaurant, you want to make sure that you let the business owner know that you are doing something separate, so that way the business owner can't come back and say it was their property. So there's a lot to define and clarify there when it comes to recipes. But you do want to make sure, too, that you know who owns it, so you don't get in trouble for it later on, because we have seen chefs take things other places, and then a business owner comes back and says, hey, nope, you can't do that. That was mine.
Yeah, you thunk tank that under my restaurant.
Exactly.
Well, Jen, thank you very much. And if you have any more questions, contact Forest Firm. And here are the details. To learn more about the Forest Firm and what they can do for you, click the link in our show notes or visit forestfirm.com/NCFB to request a free consultation for your business. You can also reach them at 877-669-1455. Forest Firm, business attorneys across North Carolina.
We are the Food and Beverage Podcast. When I know you maybe didn't write about these, but was there any beverage component? Did anyone bring out wine or a special drink, or did the Greek woman, Nelly, bring out some ouzo? Was there any cool beverages that you got to experience as well?
So when I was cooking with the Peruvian woman.
Peruvian, South American, beautiful.
Yes. So the Peruvian woman made a couple of different drinks. What happened with the book was when I went to the publisher, you know, everything needs to be consistent. So because I didn't have a ton of drinks,
yeah,
the drinks kind of got cut from the book because you just can't have one drink.
Sure.
But
we're getting behind the scenes of the book though, like your personal experience.
So the one drink that I had that was really good is pisco. It's mm-hmm. I would say probably the national drink of Peru.
Absolutely.
So she was very proud of that.
Nice.
Other than that, no, I didn't really focus on it. It was more you know, mains, desserts, appetizers, things that people make on the weekends.
Cool. Before we get too far away, let's plug the book. So again, it's called Heirloom Kitchen. It's coming out on April 23rd, right? And it'll be available everywhere you can get books, I'm assuming, Barnes & Noble, Amazon.
Yeah, it's already up for pre-sale on all of your, you know, favorite book websites, Amazon being one of them, probably the most popular, but you know, if you have a favorite.
I'm not familiar with that company. Amazon? Is that?
Know.
Oh, it must be from South America. I get it. Yeah.
Yeah. Some pronounce it Amazon, but yeah. Yeah. So you can get it now. It'll show up on your doorstep on April 23rd. Next month. I'm very excited about it. Yeah. So all books are sold.
Well, let's get in. I want to know, let's talk technique, because you talk about recipe. Mm. But with technique, I always find it to be interesting. And I'll give a for instance. And I think technique sometimes happens by mistake, and then it's done a few times over, and then that's now the way you do it. And that's also like, you know, well, that's how my grandma used to always do it. And I've told a couple chefs, in fact, when we were talking to Nick Anderer up in New York, who's the chef at Maialino, and he works for USHG. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, USHG.
USHG with Danny Meyer and all. We were having this great conversation off mic, and I was so mad that we didn't put it on mic because we were talking. My mom grew up in an orphanage. We don't have grandmas. Like there's no family before my mom, essentially, and so that we didn't get technique or learn these handed down stories. So I myself will be a huge fan and user of your cookbook because I'd love to see what other people might have received in their hand-me-downs of knowledge. But one of the things my mom did, because now she's a grandma, so she qualifies, was she would take raw or uncooked pasta and put it in a pan with just a little bit of butter, maybe a little bit of oil, and she would, you know, kind of cook it, sear it, and start getting a little burnt crispiness to the noodle. And then as she was roasting it, essentially, and covering it with a little butter, salt, oil, then she'd slowly start adding water in, and it gets this great smoky flavor. She throws some onions in there. Usually the noodle of choice was a seashell, you know, like one of those. And then she throws some onions in there, and then ultimately would throw good old Campbell's cheese sauce, just open the can and drop it in there. And so it was our version of mac and cheese, but it had this smoky quality to it. And I'm telling Nick Anderer about this, who really understands Roman cooking and, you know, from scratch. And he told me exactly, he's like, oh, she's using this technique. And it was like something that is really cool and edgy now that people are doing, like cooking raw pasta noodles and then boiling them or then, you know, reducing them down into water. And I thought, wow, my mom was coming up with a cool technique way before. And I asked my mom, why did you do that? She goes, what do you mean? I said, why did you cook the noodles like first before boiling them? She's like, I had no idea how to cook noodles. And I went, what? She goes, I thought that's the way you're supposed to. I thought they were softened up in the butter and the heat and all. And then you'd put water in. I just did it because no one ever taught me. I'm like, wow. Well, you created a technique that is delicious, and I implore anyone to try it because it gets this smoky flavor. I mean, who knows? She's probably handing us all these carcinogens that I didn't realize and, like, you know, just took a couple years off my life. But it's delicious, and it was fun. So with that established, was
there
any—
Can I just say for one second, buddy, like, they say great minds think alike, and I just want you to read what my note was there.
Max, would Anna cook your mom—
What would?
Oh, the fried noodle dish. Wow. You had that on there. That's awesome. But sadly, like, there's not a lot of great culinary stories from good old Rita Trujillo. She can make some tostadas better than most, and that was kind of our dish. That's probably what she would have made if you had interviewed her. I'm saying this in the past tense. My mom is alive and well. She's great. Anyhow, so with that, is there a technique or something that you picked up from one of these grandmas that you were like, oh, like that's something that I never thought how I would never approach a dish this way, and maybe something you picked up that you'll now incorporate into your own style?
There was a lot of stuff like that. Just cooking with people from different parts of the world, you learn so much about just how they handle ingredients, what they do, why they do it. And the other thing that I just found really funny was that, you know, in my kitchen, I have every type of appliance you could possibly think of. I mean, I have an ice cream maker, I have a processor. I mean, there's nothing that comes out on the market. I don't own a hot pot. I'm really trying to resist the urge to buy one, but I have pretty much everything else.
Is that like an Instapot? Is that what that is? Is that the same thing?
Yeah, the instant. Yeah, that thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. The Instapot. Avoiding it. I don't know why, yeah. But it's the one thing I don't own. But anyway, these women have nothing. They cook with their two hands, wooden spoons. So many of them would hold up a wooden spoon and be like, I brought this here. I've had this wooden spoon for 30. It's like, how do you still use that same wooden spoon? Like literally spoons that are 40 years old.
You're like, there's a lot of fungus on that spoon now. It's actually a detriment to your cooking.
Or maybe it helps. Maybe there's some like
bacteria. Let's call them seasoned. The spoons are seasoned. The pans are seasoned.
It's like that. It's like that scene in Meet the Fockers when he makes his paella. You know, the Dustin Hoffman character, Bernard Focker, and he goes, "You know the secret to this pan? I never washed it.
I like how you said exactly.
That's how he says it. Yeah.
The flavors bake in.
Yeah.
And that's called seasoned. So I loved just how simple things were. You know, when I was cooking with the Greek woman, she's like, when you're making the spanakopita, you need to really make sure you get all the water out of the spinach.
Mm.
I'm like, oh, I was like, do you use cheesecloth? And yeah, I mean, cheesecloth is not like some high tech.
That's highfalutin right
there. It's literally thin paper towel. Like if you would like the easiest way. Right. And she's like, what's that? I use my hands.
Like, oh, so she just like wringed it out. Like
rings it out with her hands. And I'm sitting there like, oh, do you use cheesecloth? like I was saying to like, you know, a cave person, like, do you use fire?
Yeah. What? That's interesting though. I like that. I mean, yeah. I love the quaintness because people have been cooking for so long before Instapots existed or induction burners or whatever it was. Yet the food was still delicious. So yeah, there is a way that you can do this without high tech.
Yeah, I didn't cook sous vide with anyone.
That would actually be really interesting if you did find a grandma and she's like, oh yeah, here's my, you know, molecular gastronomy. 50-year-old
sous vide machine brought over from the Ukraine.
But that
the
does...
only thing I brought in my briefcase.
Yeah, it was the sous vide. I came here with a sous vide machine and nothing and 2 cents and 2 dimes in my pocket. So when you're, because your expertise comes into making these recipes available for kind of anybody from the novice to the home cook to the accomplished cook, do you do very extensive recipe testing with these recipes as well?
The ones I did. I mean, so I would come home with just literally a notebook of like scratches that like, this is what she did. Oh, wait a minute. No, I forgot this. And I'd have to like go back. My notebooks were a disaster. So I'd come home and right away, like just transcribe everything that I learned. I took a lot of pictures and video when I was with them just to remind myself of just the process. And then there were a lot of phone calls like back and forth. Right. Like, did you do this? I don't remember this part. And it's funny because I say all the time, I feel like I really gained like 39 new grandmothers because, you know, I legitimately became friends with every one of these women. Like I'll call them up and they're all just so proud of the project. They're proud. A lot of these women, when I cooked with them, this was like me on my blog. Like, hi, will you cook with me? Me and my 7 friends are going to, you know, make this recipe someday.
Right.
And so the fact that we went from that, I mean, we had every single one of them professionally photographed for the book. So they all got to get dolled up and you know, go to the studio and get photographed. And they've all read their stories and seen their recipes in recipe format. So they're all really excited. And it's just really nice to have this kind of band of women behind me that are cheering, you know, cheering me on, cheering the book on. And everyone's very excited.
Well, so we're recording this on a Monday, right? 3 days after International Women's Day, which was just on Friday. And I can't think of a better example of celebrating international women in general, but also to the point of taking generations of women from yesteryear, not even just last generation, but we're going back too if we're talking about grandmas sometimes. In that, you know, the movie that just came out, The Wife, with Glenn Close, you know, she was nominated for an Academy Award. I don't know if you're familiar with the storyline, but she essentially lived her entire life for her husband. And she was, you know, it's that whole adage, you know, behind every great man is a strong woman. Well, that's a really like nice way of saying that the woman was always behind the man and didn't really get her due. And I think culturally that was, and many times even in other countries currently today, that's still the business model of the family, is the husband goes out and he kind of shines and does all this while the woman does so much for the family in the back role, in the back scenes. But she herself almost feels void of her own time, and that her time isn't as important as, say, the husband's time. And I think that was kind of the message they were getting across in the movie, was that this is your time. Your life is just as important as anybody else's life. It's time for you to do something. So I love the idea and what you just kind of alluded to, where these women had to get all dolled up and they had to get ready and someone was focusing on them, talking about the thing that really became the centerpiece of their family, their food. And so what a beautiful way to highlight women, grandmothers, and grandmothers not just from like now, but from yesteryear, to really show like the value that they brought to their family and their community. So good on you. That was amazing. That's amazing that you've done this.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, I would say that the common quality with all these women is just how humble they all were. And that was so endearing that it was like, what, me? Like you want to cook with me? What am I? Like this, what's this? Nothing. I just throw a couple things in a pot. And
yeah,
they never like really realized what they were doing. And you know, women today, it is totally, it's a very different mindset. And it's very important that that mindset has been created. But a lot of these women, you know, they don't look at it like, oh, you know, I was in the back, and that was their role. And they were very proud of that role and putting food on the table and making their children feel happy and safe and, you know, well fed, is just what's important to them. Someone said something to me the other day and it really touched me. She said, you know, a mother's full when the children have eaten. And I would say that that for me, like when she said that, it like really struck me, because I was like, wow, that is like the symbol of every woman I cooked with. Like, it's all about the kids. It's why they came here. You know, I do believe we're all children of immigrants, and you can go back, and every one of us can go back and find someone that came over. Like for me, it's recent. Other people, it's not as much, but somebody decided, you know, to pick up their two bags and leave. And most of them left their parents, left their support system, left their friends.
Not their sous vide machine.
But not their sous vide machine that was packed. No. And came here, and you know, we don't even think about it. Like there was no TripAdvisor. There was no, you know, let me scope out the good restaurants in the area. It was, I have no idea where I'm going. I just know it's going to be better for my family if I do.
Yeah.
And the bravery that I think none of us today have. When do you go someplace and you don't do extensive research, get on Facebook, ask all your friends, you know, where you should go, who you should stay with, you know, get mad if, you know, the hotel doesn't change the towels every day. I mean, we live so differently now.
Yeah.
We're shitty is what you're saying. We're shitty people is what you're saying.
No, it's not.
We have so much more access to information that we're rarely uncalculated. Yeah.
I mean, why would we not? We have the information, you know, or like even people today, like your companies decide you need to go work in Japan for 2 years. There's your reload package and all this stuff. It's just our reality, and that's great. And that's fine. I just want people to look back and say, wow, like, wow, my family is here because someone with a void of information took that leap so that their future generations could have a better life. And it's really cool. And I got to see it 40 times.
And it's courageous. And also, just to bring it back to food for a second, when you're cooking these recipes, I wonder how many times something came up to the effect of, oh, we used to get a certain type of spinach, or we used to get a certain type of noodle that you can't actually get here. And all these mothers coming over there, or maybe they weren't mothers at the time, you know, they have to go seek out those ingredients that they, or different ingredients that they were cooking with in their homeland.
So I have a really funny story from the woman from the Ukraine.
Okay.
Yeah. So she's a doctor. She was Jewish. She wanted to get out of the Ukraine for, you know, many different reasons. And her husband every day was trying to get them out of the Ukraine and going downtown and asking and trying to get on these lists. Very stressful. So she's in the kitchen packing the herbs for winter because it gets cold and you have to pack all your herbs in salt so that you can make borscht, which is a very traditional, you know, Ukrainian Russian soup that you eat all winter long.
Yeah.
So she's packing the herbs, you know, meticulously. And he comes in the kitchen and he's like, Celia, we can go. They called us. We can pack and pack. We start packing, get the boys, we can go. And she goes, what am I going to do with these herbs?
She doesn't know what's going to be in New York or so. Yeah.
How she's going to make her borscht in New York.
Well, first of all, the husband told me this story, like kvetching to me in the kitchen when she was cooking and she was like kicking him out. And it was hilarious, the whole thing. But when I went home and thought about this story and like how the family like tells the story about one, how like the parents always bicker and like nothing's ever good enough for the mom. And it's like this funny family joke. The reality was, it was, what am I going to do? I need to be able to make borscht this winter.
Yeah.
And if I don't have these herbs, and I'm in Queens, which is where they ended up, what am I going to do?
Yeah.
And she said, she goes, the first thing she did, I mean, and this woman was an accomplished doctor. The first thing when she got here was left their apartment and started going out to see what the stores had
right.
that she could use for her soups. And that was always the primary focus. Like, how am I going to feed my family? And by doing that, they were figuring out how they were going to take home and bring it here. And that's what they did.
Yeah. And I'm wondering, did the borscht taste different in Queens than it was in the Ukraine?
I think they managed.
Okay. They figured it out. They worked the recipe.
You know, I Matt and I love the, you know, the entrepreneurial stories that happen. And you alluded to this just very quickly, but I kind of want to know, you've been doing all these various things as a, you know, working for Martha Stewart and doing recipes and all, but you got a book deal. Mm-hmm. How did that happen? Could you walk us down a little bit? Like, you know, you have this idea and then now someone's going to give you hopefully a little bit of cash to make this happen so that you could focus your time for it, you know, so that you can actually make a deal. How'd you do this?
Okay. So how to get a cookbook deal. It's funny. MSN just asked me to write an article on this. Cause I think it's like really important for people. They want to know how you get a book deal. After I got a book deal, a lot of people start asking me, yeah. Can I talk to your agent? I have this really good idea for a book. So the first thing I would say is you have to have a really good idea and not just any old idea. I think people are really looking for something new and novel. And again, another Martha Stewartism, she says, find the gap, find something that's not already out there. Hmm. And I think that that's really important. And I think that's what I did. I found something that hasn't been done and that people are interested in. So hopefully the book sells and I prove my theory correct. So that's the first thing. The second thing I would say is that you need to do a lot of the work yourself, and that's building a platform. I kind of shudder when people call me an influencer, but I guess that's what I've become.
But you have really 91,000 followers on Instagram, so you've at least influenced a few people. I'll say that.
I know, but it's kind of it's a strange term, you know, like you don't grow up saying, I want to grow up and be an influencer.
Although now
although kids today, probably. Yeah,
I'm pretty sure my daughters will probably say that pretty soon.
I know. My daughter said that someone came up to her in the hallway the other day and was like, did you know that your mom has 90,000 followers on Instagram? And my daughter said, yeah, how do you know?
Well, I'm one of the 90,000.
Yeah. So, it's really important. I mean,
so 91,000. Build your brand, like build what you're going to do.
100%. You need to build your brand.
Yeah.
Have a very beautiful website that people want to visit. Create a beautiful platform on Instagram. Create a Facebook page that people really want to visit. You need to become kind of like a celebrity in a way. And I am by no means a celebrity, but create that platform like where
persona
people want to know what you're doing and why you're doing it.
Yeah.
Because the publishing world is not going to do that for you. And I'm learning that now more than ever with being now in the PR process. And I love HarperCollins and they're doing so much for me, but it's all based on the stuff that I built up on my own first.
Yeah.
You know, Instagram is a great platform for selling things like books. Well, when you have a lot of followers, that makes things easier. And also when you have a beautiful website for people to look at, then I would say you really do need to find an agent. And I know that's difficult. A lot of agents are not taking new customers, clients, whatever you want to call them. I got lucky. I will absolutely call it my big break that I met someone that had a couple of cookbooks under his belt, loved my idea and said, let me introduce you to my agent.
Hmm.
I would not have gotten in the door otherwise. So if you put this in Hollywood terms, that was absolutely my big break. I was able to get in the door. They liked the idea. They said, you got more work to do. We're not going to sign anything with you yet. If you do X, Y, and Z, which was continue to build up your platform, make sure you get things published online, get more grandmas. You know, they gave me my to-do list. I did it. I went back to her. I kept following up every month. This is what I'm doing. This is what I'm working on. I'm now the blogger for this site. I'm now the blogger for that site. I have this appearance scheduled. And then a year later, it was like, yeah, Anne, I think it's time. And she took me out to lunch and she said, I just want to tell you, I sit down with so many people. And the conversation is always, what can I do for them? Hmm. And with you, it was, what can you do to get this done? She's like, and you did everything. And so I think good old fashioned hard work can't be underestimated either.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, people ask me like, oh, I want to do a podcast. I'll do a podcast. I'm happy to tell everybody every single step that it takes to do a podcast. And people think, oh, you're giving away your intellectual, you know, property. I'm like, no, these are kind of obvious things. I'm just going to put them all together for you. The big thing is you yourself have to do it. And that's where the rubber meets the road. That's where the separation, you know, the man from the boys, the girls from the, you know, women and all. But that's the difference is you can, someone can tell you how to do it, but you ultimately have to do it. And, but you did it so perfectly. There's three points. Come up with a great idea, build mm-hmm. your brand, and get representation. That's basically what you said. And it seems so simple and it's like, oh yeah, no duh. But in between all those three steps, there was a ton of work to get you to the point of what would allow you to even approach the next step, I would say.
But right. I also want to add that you gave your followers, let's say, or people who are into your brand, a tangible takeaway with the recipes and the story. So it's not just a story and it's not a story about Anna. It's a story about a grandmother. And then, oh, I have this recipe which I can cook for my family. And that's a tangible takeaway. And before we get out of here, I got to talk about something else that you can get a takeaway. And that's Triangle Wine Company,
yeah.
where you can get deliveries. Or you can go into one of their four locations in Southern Pines, Morrisville, or Cary, or Holly Springs, and you can get your takeaways for any of your beer, wine, mixers, non-alcoholic yeah. mixer stuff. Plus, you can go and have a great drink at the bar. They get some awesome beers there, really cool releases, and they have a great online website, which you can have fun and sometimes even get deliveries for your takeaways.
Use promo code NCFB if you're shopping online. You'll get 10% off because of us. Thank yeah. you. You're welcome. And, you know, what you were saying about building your brand, because I don't want to gloss over that too much. It's so important about what you do. I was in a band for a long time, and one of the best lessons I learned from Randy Weitzel, he's now in this big metal band in this moment, and he has like 180,000 followers, and he's an excellent guitarist. But when we were first like learning songs, I'd come up with a riff or an idea, a word, a chorus, and he'd go, yeah, that's good, man. Come up with a complete idea. Like, he goes, and this is the reason why, and I think this is such sage advice. He said, if you give me, say, a chorus or a riff or whatever, and then ask me to help you, now it's my song or it's our song. And you might not like where I'd go with this next step. You might think, oh man, he kind of ruined my idea. Well, only you know what your idea is. So fully conceptualize, actualize. The only time at that point, if you're just stuck, you get another person to help. But it helped me understand like, oh yeah, I should do this whole thing myself and become like do it as well as you can. And that's almost like your Instagram was almost like your book. It was like your demo tape for your book. It was like, let's have pictures. Let's have food. Let's have recipes. This is basically publishing houses, what I could do for you if you want to hire me.
100%. Yep. It's like, this is my idea. I'm presenting it to the world already and I have interest.
Yeah.
So now you just have to pay to get it on paper.
Let's put pen to paper.
Yeah, that's exactly what you do. And it's funny, like, I hate to quote it because I'm probably the only person in the world that doesn't like the movie A Star is Born.
Haven't seen it.
Whoa.
But
it's okay. I know everything.
At one point, there's one huge takeaway, and Bradley Cooper is talking to Lady Gaga, and he says, every single person in this bar is talented. Everyone's born with talent, but not everybody has something to say.
Yeah.
So yeah. I was like, that is so profound. I'm going to take that one sentence from this movie because it's true. And it's like you said, it's all about hard work and follow through. If you have a great idea, if you really believe in yourself, you got to believe in yourself today, tomorrow, the next day. You have to keep working at it. Like, I look back on the past 4 years of my life. It's like I was living and breathing this book even well before it was a book. And I truly believe when you open up this book, you will see that. You will see my stories. You will see the photography that is absolutely exquisite, Andrew Fitzgervani from The Times. And I got him because he loved the idea. I had all the women give me ephemera. So I have passport photos from when they got here. I have pictures from the old country. I have, you know, the mixing bowl that they brought, the measuring cup that they brought, photographed all over throughout the book. So it's a passion project, and I really hope that that comes through for people.
Absolutely.
Matt, I want to ask you a question. I'm putting you on blast now.
Uh-oh.
Matt. If Anna ever called over at the Weiss family to speak with Ellen,
yeah,
what would your mom have made as her
Ellen's a great cook. Yeah. I have eaten at Ellen's house.
See, she's eaten at Ellen's house, so she could answer the question. you know, there's the traditional, like, holiday meals, brisket, gefilte fish, although we would never make gefilte. I mean, some people make gefilte fish. She wouldn't, but
a lady in my book did.
Oh, really? No. My cousin out here, Cindy, she makes great gefilte fish, actually. But my mom would probably do the traditionals. Matzo balls, brisket, and a good matzo braai, because on Passover, you don't eat bread, so breakfast can get hard, and matzo braai was really good. My mom did that really well. But the funny thing is, ironically, my mom would also cook Italian food because, like, she had some Italian cousins. So I always asked for lasagna on my birthday for her lasagna. So, yeah. Nice. And if you remember at my house, I made and baked ziti, and that was also, like, her recipe. And so.
And your dad knows how to flip an egg, apparently.
Yeah. My dad knows how to flip an egg. But, okay, so this is all really good and beautiful talk, and everyone's feeling good. I want to get gossipy for a second.
Okay.
What are the outtakes? Like, did you have to cut out some grandmas, or, like, were some Nona's cooking just not really good, and you're like, nah, I'm not going to get that dish?
She's not going to say.
You don't have to say the names.
I really would. And I honestly, that did not. I mean,
so you had 40, and all 40 made the book.
Yeah. I mean,
she vetted them. I imagine you vetted these women
a little bit, but it was not me vetting. It was people vetting. Like, I would meet someone and be like, oh, you know, you're Vietnamese. Let's talk, you know?
Yeah.
And then sometimes they'd say, oh, you know, my dad did all the cooking, or yeah, my mom is not a good cook.
Right.
You know? So I definitely had people pre-vet. And whenever someone said to me, you need to cook with my mom, I was pretty good. It worked out really well.
But don't like 90% of the people think their mom's a really good cook, and then, like, other people have their
case? I don't know. I had a lot of people tell me that their moms were terrible cooks.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah. Maybe I had a lot of people even now. I think you feel that way, Matt, because your mom is a really good cook.
Okay. Turns out people are more.
He was teasing his mom.
Yeah, that's true. Turns out people are more honest than I thought. Yeah.
They are. I think they are. I think people know. And, yeah, and then I'd also hear from, like, friends of friends, like, oh, yeah, I've been there. Her food is really good. I will tell you, no one got cut. And yes, every experience was great. There were times that they'd be cooking something, and I'd be like, ugh, what am I going to do? And it was me. I will tell you, the borscht. I was afraid to eat borscht.
Okay.
It's red. It's got a lot of beets, boiled stuff. I was like, I don't know about this.
Well, let me some borscht.
I loved it. It was embarrassing how much of the borscht I was eating. So,
I don't know. I got to go find some borscht in Raleigh right now.
Yeah. Well, Anna, this is amazing. I feel like I know you now after this conversation and closer. I got to get the book. So one more time, let's shout it out.
Yeah, Heirloom Kitchen. Get it on April 23rd. Pre-order it on Amazon. And follow Anna on Instagram at...
It's at Anna F. Goss, at AnnaFGASS.
So go follow Anna. Get the book. You will eat and drink very merrily.
Thanks for listening to the NCF&B podcast. And if you've stuck with us this long, review us on iTunes, and remember, 5 stars are encouraged.